From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. What a program in store for you tonight and later tonight, ET Contact. Here's what's happening. North Korea once again fires more weapons, denouncing U.S. military drills. We've got to work this situation out. It's getting tense. Meanwhile, Iran has unveiled what it described as three new precision-guided missiles, as its president warned of the mother of all wars if the U.S. attacks them at all. A U.S. aircraft carrier sailing through the disputed South China Sea in the latest show of America's military might amid new territorial flare-ups involving China and rival claimant states. Federal authorities have announced that they have launched a domestic terrorism investigation into the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting in Northern California, which left three people, including two children, dead. Now, this happened a couple days before the other episodes. Tragic story there. And the horrific mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton that left 31 people dead and dozens more injured have thrust the issue of gun violence into the center of the 2020 presidential campaign, with calls calling for louder voices in the Democratic field for the return of an assault weapons ban. Let's check in with our expert on the human brain, Howard Bloom. Howard, welcome to the program, and tell me your thoughts on this. This is a tough issue. Isn't this a Second Amendment issue?
It's a Second Amendment issue, but the difficulty is that there was nothing like an assault rifle back in the times of the American Revolution, nothing like it at all. And all three of these, you know, we've had three mass murders in a total of 7 days. As you said, we've had 34 Americans killed, which is more than all the Americans killed in the Afghanistan war in the last 3 years. The assault weapons used are capable of between 75 and 100 shots without reloading. So yes, there's no reason assault rifles should be on the North American continent, but there's more. I mean, there's a weapon that nobody is looking at. All the shooters were young white men between 19 and 24 years old. And so why are white young men going out with military weapons and killing as many innocent civilians as they can find? Now, here's the deal. We humans need four things: community, a goal, status, and hope. Extremist movements offer all four of these. Look, young men in any society are leaving their family, going out on their own, looking for mates, and trying to seek their fortune in a world that often does not seem to want them. And, George, that hurts. Across many cultures and across the eons, human societies have handled the pains of angry young men by turning those young men into warriors, warriors in the Maasai tribe in Africa, warriors in the armies of Alexander the Great, warriors of Islam, or members of China's People's Liberation Army, or recruits in the U.S. military. And warriors are, guess what? They're killers. But some men just don't fit in. These are the people given a community, a purpose, hope, and possible status in extremist groups like the Islamic State, in a socialist revolution, or in the white supremacist community. For example, white supremacism aims to incite a race war. For what purpose? To eradicate or reduce the lands of non-whites and to set up a transcontinental whites-only Aryan state. That goal is ghastly. It involves getting rid of me, a Jew. It involves getting rid of you, George. And it involves eradicating many of the people who are listening to us. The white supremacist movement delivers a sense of belonging and a chance to become a legend in a new movement, the way that Anders Breivik became a legend in 2011. Anders Breivik set off a car bomb that killed 8 in Oslo, Norway, then went to an island summer camp for young Labour Party kids and killed 69 of them. He issued a 1,518-page-long manifesto explaining his philosophy, and Anders Breivik became a man on whom others modeled themselves. One of those who modeled themselves on Anders Breivik was Brenton Tarrant, the New Zealand shooter who mowed down 51 worshippers this march with an assault rifle in a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand, then published a manifesto just like Breivik's. He, too, became a legend, and he had his first imitators in only 4 months. The El Paso shooter was following the New Zealand shooter's pattern and said so in his manifesto. The California Garlic Festival shooter was politically motivated, too. He had target lists of religious institutions, politicians from both sides of the aisle, and federal buildings and courthouses. His last Instagram post referred to a white supremacist material. And the Dayton shooter was a Democrat who viewed posts about the El Paso killer's deeds on Twitter, marked them with a like, then hours later, went out and followed the El Paso murderer's example.
He even killed his sister.
Yes, and he killed his sister. So if you want to become a legend in a new tribe, mass murder seems like one way to do it.
So, but here's my big question for you, Howard.
Go ahead.
Would you ban assault rifles or not?
Absolutely. Immediately. You can own a weapon without owning an assault rifle.
Interesting take. Howard Bloom's take. And it's a tough call. President Donald Trump has dismissed concerns over a protracted trade war with China, as Beijing warned that Washington's decision to label it a currency manipulator would lead to chaos in the financial markets. Markets picked up a little bit today. The Federal Reserve president in St. Louis, James Bullard, said during a speech that it's too soon to tell whether a second interest rate cut is warranted. They did that last week, 0.25%. I think they'll probably do it again in about a month. As U.S. stocks suffered their steepest drop of 2019 yesterday, big tech was hit particularly hard. Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, and Facebook, the five most valuable U.S. companies, lost a combined $162 billion Monday, leading the broader market rout, which was sparked by concerns of this trade war with China. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, why did the techs take it? Because most of this hardware is built in China?
Well, we have to back up one step. I mean, basically what's happening here is that President Trump is playing macroeconomic chicken with the Chinese, and this is impacting the markets, including tech and the rest of the economy. There's good reason to suspect that China, I mean, their economy has major weaknesses now. They could still come out on top because they play the long game. They don't play an impulsive game. They own a lot of our debt. Their economy is centrally controlled, so they have a lot of levers they can pull. Just as they devalued their currency just a few days ago, that was in retribution for Trump's latest tariffs. They announced that they're cutting back drastically on agricultural purchases, and there's a lot of other countries they could deal with too. Tech always takes a big hit in these situations because China's market power is still enormous, and so many tech supply chains depend on China. And as a practical matter, most of those supply chains and those supply manufacturing elements aren't going to return to the U.S. in the foreseeable future because we just can't compete with the kinds of low wages they have in China. Now, one thing that may be confusing a lot of people here, I mean, this all is tied in with these tariffs. And President Trump keeps claiming that China is paying the tariffs that he's imposing on Chinese imports that are triggering all these reactions. But that's just not accurate. The tariffs ultimately add to the prices we pay for those goods.
That's right.
The country imposing tariffs is always the country that ends up paying for them. That's how tariffs are supposed to work. They're supposed to make goods more expensive for the importing country. And in this case, that's us. This is economics 101. And it's kind of disturbing that this basic point keeps getting muddled because these are very important policy discussions. The economics have impacts all through the rest of our society. And it really matters that we understand what's really going on.
Interesting, Lauren. We'll find out what happens if this thing continues or not. Lauren Weinstein, his website is vortex.com. Astronomers believe they've discovered a supermassive black hole located 700 million light years from Earth. It has a mass of 40 billion times that of the sun. Let's hope our galaxy stays far away from that and doesn't get sucked in. President Trump has announced the United States would expand its existing sanctions against Venezuela with an executive order banning Americans doing business with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The executive order freezes assets of the government of Venezuela and associated entities and prohibits economic transactions with it unless specifically exempted. Exemptions would include official business of the federal government and the transactions related to the provision of humanitarian aid. What are we doing with Venezuela? In a moment, Dan Kovalik joins us. The plot to overthrow Venezuela, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to dabble in history for a moment for the next couple hours with Dan Kovalik back with us on Coast to Coast. His earlier book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But this one is very important because something is happening in Venezuela, and he'll explain a lot of that. His latest book is called The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. Dan, of course, currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, graduated from Columbia University School of Law back in 1993. He then served as an in-house counsel for the United Steelworkers Union until 2019. Mr. Kovalik received the David W. Mills Mentoring Fellowship from Stanford University School of Law. It was the recipient of the Project Censored Award for his article exposing the unprecedented killing of trade unionists in Colombia. And he has written extensively on the issue of international human rights and U.S. foreign policy for the Huffington Post and Counterpunch. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Dan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
By the way, how's the steel industry these days in the United States?
Well, I think it's doing fairly well. It's actually, in truth, one of the few industries that have benefited to some extent from the tariffs that Trump imposed. You know, he very much targeted foreign steel in his tariffs, and there has been a bit of a comeback in steel as a result.
Super, super. When you were on with me back in 17, we were talking about the plot to scapegoat Russia. Now that you've had a couple more years to look at this situation, where does this all fit with you?
Well, I feel, you know, pretty much the same as I did back in 2017, and that is that I think there is not much there in terms of the Russiagate allegations. You know, the Mueller report is now out. He has now testified before Congress. And, you know, Mueller was very clear that he did not find evidence of collusion between Trump and Russia in the 2016 elections, which, you know, I have believed all along there was a lack of such evidence. So I feel, you know, somewhat vindicated by that.
Now, what about terms of U.S.-Russia relations? I mean, they seem tense right now.
Yeah, well, that's another irony that again, while Trump has been and continues to be accused of being a pawn of Putin in Russia, in fact, he has become quite belligerent towards Russia. You know, he backed out of the intermediate range nuclear missile treaty of 1987, which Russia viewed as a very hostile move and was a hostile move. He has advanced NATO to, you know, further to the borders of Russia. And yes, we have very bad relations with Russia now. In fact, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which has that atomic clock showing how close we are to possible nuclear war, has moved it to 3 minutes to midnight, the closest it's been.
Not good.
Many years, yeah.
Not good. And, of course, your latest book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. Isn't Putin very involved in Venezuela for a lot of reasons, including the oil as well?
Well, he is certainly involved, as is China. Though the interesting thing, and this is fairly typical, you know, in large part, Russia's involved because the U.S. has tried to isolate it, and so Venezuela turned to Russia and China. So that is to say that while it's true Russia and China are involved, in a lot of ways the U.S. has pushed Venezuela towards the east in order to be able to sell oil. At this point, Venezuela is unable to benefit from any of the oil it has been selling in the U.S. and now has decided simply to stop selling it.
What is it about some of these countries and you know, heads of state that we just don't get along with? Certain, like Hugo Chavez, we couldn't stand his guts. Why not? Why couldn't we work out a deal with the guy?
Yeah, well, I think a deal could have been made. I mean, we first of all have to recall that, you know, Chavez, whatever you think of him, you know, he offered to help after Katrina to send doctors and other medical assistance. He gave affordable oil for heating to people in New England and New York City. He really thought under Obama that he would have a friend in the White House, which never happened. I mean, I think we could have made a deal with him. The problem with Chavez and now with Maduro is that they have insisted on nationalizing Venezuelan oil. You know, for about 100 years, Venezuelan oil really was dominated by the U.S. and U.S. corporations who were able to profit, heavily from that oil, and then Chavez nationalized that oil and began to use it for the benefit of the Venezuelan people. And that's really the issue that the U.S. has had with him, very much like, and people need to remember, with Mosaddegh in Iran in the early 1950s.
And look what happened to him.
Right. The U.S. helped to overthrow him because he nationalized Iranian oil. And so I think that is what this comes down to. And, you know, in truth, Trump and John Bolton have been pretty open about the fact that oil is a big motivator here. Bolton has talked about the fact he's already been meeting with U.S. oil companies to start divvying up the Venezuelan oil once the U.S. Is able to topple the current government, if indeed that does happen.
And Daniel, explain, as we get into this, the current presidential dispute about this term election with Maduro, that people are questioning whether it's authentic or not. What happened?
Yeah, so first of all, and by the way, I've been an election observer in Venezuela at least half a dozen times since 2013. I was an observer of the presidential elections in both 2013. That's right after Chavez died, and that was when Nicolas Maduro was elected by a very narrow margin back in 2013. Pretty much everyone agrees that you know, he fairly won that election, again, by a bit, just less than 2% of vote. He then ran for election again in May 2018. I observed those elections as well. About 49% of the population voted at that time, a lot less than usual, because the opposition did call for abstention, and there was significant abstention from voting, meaning that a lot of folks did sit home, but again, nearly 50% did vote, and of those who voted, 67% voted for Nicolas Maduro, which was a significant margin of the vote. And so, you know, from the point of view of myself and many others, I mean, he was legitimately elected. So along comes this Juan Guaido, who earlier this year announced, in fact, that he was president.
Was he the candidate, the other candidate?
No, he's never run for president.
Oh, so he just popped up all of a sudden?
He popped up. He has the rotating, their National Assembly, like our Congress, has a rotating head, like it would be similar to the Speaker of the House, only there it rotates every so often. And he got the rotating position and then said, well, as the head of the National Assembly, I'm now going to declare myself president. But he never ran for president. And in fact, at the time he declared himself president, a public opinion poll showed that 80% of Venezuelans didn't even know who he was. And this is the guy, of course, the U.S. is backing to be president. Now, that gambit has seemed to have pretty much failed. I mean, in fact, many people in the opposition opposed him because he wasn't even a significant opposition leader. In fact, he announced on stage at an opposition rally in Caracas, he announced his presidency, and other opposition leaders were taken aback. And they feel that he does not represent them. So that whole gambit that the U.S. has been running seems to have run out of steam.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Now, why don't we get along with Maduro? Is he a henchman? Is he a too strong arm? Does he kill off people? What's wrong with this guy?
You know, no. I mean, again, I think the problem that the U.S. has with him is the same that they had with Chavez, and that is that they want to control Venezuela's oil. Maduro doesn't want that to happen. Maduro wants to keep Venezuelan oil in the hands of the Venezuelan country and the Venezuelan people, and the U.S. has other ideas about
that. Like Saudi Arabia does.
Exactly. And again, like the U.S., you know, in a number of occasions has acted to overthrow governments when they saw a chance to control their natural resources or oil or gold. Libby is an example of that in 2011.
Hold on for a second, Daniel. We're at the break at the bottom of the hour here, but we'll come back and talk more about your work, the plot to overthrow Venezuela. We've got a lot of people who would probably say, so what does this all mean to me? So we'll get into that, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Dan's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with Dan Kovalik next hour as we talk about the plot to overthrow Venezuela. Those of you into ETs and alien abductions, we'll be doing about that at the end of the program tonight on Coast to Coast, the second half as well. And welcome back to Coast, Dan Kovalik with us. His book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. We'll take your calls next hour with Dan. Dan, I love this country. Spent 9 years in the Navy. I would risk my life for it. There's no better nation, but I'm beginning to really understand what Eisenhower said when he left office, to be wary of the military-industrial complex. Why do we get involved in all these people's business? No wonder we're hated by half the world.
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and I think there's a few answers to that. I mean, you touch upon a big one, the military-industrial complex, and what do we mean by that? We mean, in part, we mean corporations, huge corporations like Raytheon, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas, that make Boeing, in fact, that make a lot of money from war. And those companies have a lot of sway in Congress and with the Defense Department. And they profit from a war whether we win the war or we don't. In fact, they make more money if the war just continues forever, like
That's
in
right.
Afghanistan. That it looks, you know, we're now in our 19th year.
And we're negotiating with the Taliban, whom we threw out. Makes no sense.
Well, exactly. And in fact, you know, there's a good chance the Taliban will be back in there. And again, so what was the point? A lot of people will ask. In fact, there was a recent poll where a lot of the majority of military veterans said that these wars don't have a point. But again, for the companies, they do have a point. They make money by selling the armaments and the clothes and whatnot. And it's a very vicious cycle and one that we need to resist. So that's one reason. Another reason is the control of resources like oil, like Venezuela's oil, Iran's oil. And the one thing I want to emphasize with that is the word control, not access. The U.S. doesn't need access to fossil fuels. We are now a net exporter.
We are the biggest producer of oil right now in the world.
Exactly, and natural gas. So we don't need their oil in terms of using it for fuel. What we want, or when I say we, what those in power want is to be able to control the oil supplies, one, so that U.S. companies can be guaranteed to profit from it.
Right.
And also so they can keep oil prices high. And so they're just as happy, for example, in the case of Venezuela and Iran, just to knock them off line and prevent them from producing any oil. They view that as a better alternative than having those countries control their own oil. And so, I mean, it's a very concerning thing. And in the end, who loses? Obviously, those countries lose because they struggle for independence. They're subject to sanctions. You know, in Venezuela, there was a recent report co-authored by Jeffrey Sachs, a very well-respected economist out of Columbia University, who estimated that over 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions just between 2017 and 2018, and he expects more to die this year. So, of course, the countries that we're targeting for regime change are suffering, but we're also suffering in this country. Why? Because, again, we're not seeking, or the government or those in charge are not seeking the oil to be, because we need to use it, because you and I need to use it, but so that U.S. companies can profit from it. So it doesn't benefit us in any respect. Meanwhile, we're sending our soldiers to die and to kill in these wars that, again, really don't benefit, the American people.
Tell me about Oliver Stone writing the foreword to your book. He, of course, is the great filmmaker. We're very close with his son, Sean. But tell me about the Oliver Stone tie-in.
Yeah, well, Oliver's been working. People may not realize this, but in addition to the blockbuster movies he's made, like Platoon, for example, he, in the recent years, has been focusing a lot on documentaries. And he has done a number of documentaries on Cuba, on Venezuela, on South America in general. He has one called South of the Border, in which he interviews a number of various leaders in South America, including Hugo Chavez at that time. So he actually got interested in my books with the first one, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. He was doing his Putin interviews around the same time. So he became interested in that book, and then because of his interest in Latin America and in Venezuela, he was interested in this book and was generous enough to write the foreword for it.
I want you to answer what could be one criticism of you, and you have the right to answer this. I got an email from one individual, just one, and wanted to know if you really are a patriot and care about America. So I want you to answer that based on the books you wrote.
Yes, I mean, I would argue that myself, well, I can only speak for myself. I would argue that, in fact, I'm a very strong patriot. I mean, first of all, just to give, if I could give a little background, I mean, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. I went to Catholic schools my whole life. I mean, I'm a fairly traditional person in many ways. Was a labor lawyer for the steelworkers for 25 years. So I'm, again, is apple pie is anyone. In my view, is that these wars and these interventions, again, are killing us. They are killing the soul of America. We are on a collision course now, not just with these smaller countries like Venezuela and Iran, but possibly with Russia and China. We can't afford to do this. You know, we've now spent $6 trillion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan alone.
Jeez.
You know, and that's money that could be used for health care.
Oh, be used my God, protect the grid, because that's one of my big stories. And if we get hit by a solar flare or a country detonates a nuke in the atmosphere, our power grid's going to be shut down. And, you know, millions of Americans will die. We can insulate that for a couple billion dollars.
Exactly. I mean, the trillions we're spending on wars could be do so much to improve the lives of people in this country. And, you know, what folks like myself are saying is we need to be spending that money here and spending it on making this country better and safer. And that, you know, when we spend money abroad in order to line the pockets of these companies that make money from war, that isn't patriotism. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
How much of those trillions of dollars would be spread around to individuals if we gave it to Americans?
Could you imagine? I don't have a calculator in front of me, but yeah, if you just gave that money, $6 trillion to the, what, 350 million?
Yeah, just say everybody gets a piece.
It would be make a huge difference in people's lives. You know, there was this study that recently, actually, I think this came out of one sector of the U.S. government that estimated that about a majority of people in the U.S. are $400 away from insolvency. You know, $400 emergency.
They can't do it. They can't do it.
Yeah.
No. Who is Elliot Abrams?
Well, he is now the man in charge of U.S. policy towards Venezuela. It's a name from the past. He also was very prominent in the Reagan administration. He was an important figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, if people remember that. U.S. Congress had cut off aid to the Contras, the Nicaraguan Contras, twice. And so.
And by the way, when I first saw Oliver Stone, I was thinking you had Ollie North doing this. And it's funny you bring up the Contras.
Sometimes,
yeah.
Right? Ollie North and Oliver Stone. But yeah, so Ollie North and Elliot Abrams were significant figures, John Poindexter, in the Iran-Contra scandal, which was a way to give money to the Contras that were trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government at a time Congress had cut off funding. So the U.S. was selling weapons to Iran at that time, even though Iran was under an arms embargo, and using that money to pay for the Contras. Well, again,
and let me ask you this, too. Do you believe that the incoming administration before the election, that would have been Ronald Reagan, and then we had Jimmy Carter, that they cut a deal with Iran to hold the hostages until after the election?
I do believe that.
A lot of people do.
Yeah. In fact, I have another book. I don't want to plug too many books, but I do have a book on Iran called The Plot to Attack Iran, which talks about that. And there's some, people who gave, sworn testimony about their role in that. That essentially the U.S. and Israel used their assets from the Shah. People have to remember that until the Iranian Revolution 1979, the U.S. had one of its closest friends in the world in the Shah of Iran.
That's right.
That it had installed in 1953 when it overthrew.
But his greed got to him, Dan.
It got to him, and the people rose up, and they overthrew him. And at one point, as people remember, after that revolution, when Jimmy Carter welcomed the Shah into the U.S., for medical treatment for his cancer, some students took over the embassy in Iran, in Tehran, and took people hostage. And there's good evidence that the Reagan campaign worked behind the scenes to, one, derail Carter's attempts to negotiate the release of the hostages, and to, in fact, have the hostages held
safely until after the election.
Until after his inauguration, and they, in fact, were released within minutes of his inauguration in January of 1981. So that's a fascinating story, too. You know, it's known as the October Surprise. There's a book called The October Surprise, written by a journalist, Robert Perry, who recently died. Very well worth looking into.
Why can't we? I want to talk to you about Iran for a little bit. And you were in Iran back a couple of years ago as well. As you well know, the Iranian people love our way of living, the people themselves.
They do. They love Americans. I mean, what I was, really taken aback by when I went to Iran is how friendly people were, especially once they learned you were an American. They would try to show off their English to you, and many people there speak English. They wanted to get a photograph. People love Americans. And the thing that people need to understand is that even in a country like Iran, which certainly has had hostile relations with the U.S. for some time, the people themselves generally love Americans, and they distinguish the American people from the American government. That is to say that Iranians understand, well, okay, the U.S. government may be sanctioning us, threatening us, but that doesn't mean the American people hate us or want this to happen. And the Venezuelans are the same, And you're always moved by that when you go to countries, that are ostensible adversaries of the U.S., and you find the people are very welcoming and don't hold grudges against us, which I think is quite amazing.
Probably would be very easy to create peace there. I don't know why we don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. And I mean, there's a big part of me that believes that for some time the U.S. actually has not wanted peace and stability in the Middle East, again, because a lot of companies are able to profit in the midst of that chaos. There's the whole shock doctrine that Naomi Klein has written about. And I do think that peace is possible. In fact, people may forget, if they ever knew, that after 9/11, Iran, which was and is a mortal enemy of groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, offered to help the U.S. in the war against terror, did help to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan, did help fight Al-Qaeda. And the U.S. government, George W. Bush at that time, acknowledged this, but then shortly after declared Iran was part of this,
Evil axis.
Evil, yeah. So it's pretty incredible. And at that time, Iran sent a note to the U.S. State Department saying that they were willing to negotiate all issues to try to reboot the relationship with the United States, because they thought after helping with the war on terror that the U.S. would be open to this, and that letter was never responded to.
Meanwhile, China is quickly and quietly cutting deals with these nations, and they're going to benefit.
Absolutely. And frankly, what China has shown is that you can make deals with these countries without going to war, without bombing. They do it by building roads and building hospitals.
Yep.
You know, there's something to be learned there, I think.
Absolutely. How do you think Venezuela is going to unfold? I mean, so we've got Maduro in power right now. He's got, what, a couple more years before his term's up?
Yes, several. He would have, four more years.
Four more years there. So what do you think is going to happen? How's it going to unfold?
I believe that it's very likely that the Maduro government will survive. I think that there, you know, earlier this year, I really believe that that might not happen. It looked like there was a moment when he might have been vulnerable, but now he's weathered this storm with this Juan Guaido fellow. Guaido is now, by the way, under a cloud of suspicion, because it's turned out that his folks have been stealing money meant for humanitarian aid. They've been spending it on fancy hotel rooms and clothes. And also, I think he's finished.
Human
greed.
I
think the government will survive, but the problem is that the U.S. continues to impose these draconian sanctions.
And well, let's talk about sanctions, Daniel, when we come back. Plus, we'll take phone calls. Final hour just ahead with Dan Kovalik, his book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela.